What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. 411 Teen is a weekly program for teens and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that intersect, confront, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield, and joining me via phone from Detroit, Michigan, is Ida Byrd Hill. She is the author of KISS, Kids in Successful Schools Begins at Home. She also invented the board game Flute, the wealth-building game of accidental inventions. Ida will discuss effective parenting and success in school. Ida, welcome to 411 Teen.
Thank you. Glad to have be on your show.
Oh, I look forward to talking with you. Why did you write KISS Begins at Home?
Well, we teach parent workshops in quite a few urban schools. And right now we've been having a lot of debate in this country about failing schools. And while corporations and a lot of major individuals are giving their prescriptions on what should solve the problem, I decided to write a book which really creates the problem. Mm-hmm. Good schools does not start at the schoolhouse. It starts at home. When schools are failing, they're failing because the children come to school not prepared to learn what's necessary to pass standardized exams.
Indeed. Indeed. I'm glad you wrote that. I mean, it certainly offers a very realistic perspective and a different perspective, which is much needed. How does parenting actually influence children's academic and school success?
First of all, what most people do not realize, most standardized exams are really based on two things specifically, vocabulary and culture.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have failing schools, the one thing that you see right quickly is that students are lacking in vocabulary and they haven't been exposed to a lot of things that standardized exams test.
Mm-hmm.
But let's deal with the vocabulary first. Research shows that when a child is born at age zero, by the time they get to three, depending upon the vocabulary that their parents utilize, they can either have a really good vocabulary or they can have a very poor vocabulary. But what they have noted is that individuals in affluent households have a much stronger vocabulary than individuals who have poorer parents, and partly because more affluent parents use more broader vocabulary with their children. The second thing that we see with that vocabulary is that a lot of times parents begin reading to their children 10, 20, 30 minutes a day from birth, and that improves vocabulary immensely. In a lot of households where you have failing schools, those parents are not reading bedtime stories to their kids. And so, consequently, the vocabularies are not growing fast enough to keep up with the testing environment.
Well, that reminds me of an experience that I had in working with some clients here. And, you know, if all the parents get in the mail are bills and flyers, reading is not important.
Mm-mm.
Mm-mm. It's just not a priority. Who wants to read bills all the time? And flyers are something that you don't have the money to buy anything.
but even deeper than that, though, the thing that I just laughed, though, you know, we have these wonderful public libraries.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I remind people there were times in American history when African-Americans and Hispanic-Americans and immigrants could not go to an American library.
Mm-hmm. That's
now we
true.
Have free access to libraries, and we don't
and
have
we still don't go.
Why?
Yeah. Of course, and another factor that you brought up really is tied with economics and household income. It's what I hear. Would you agree or disagree?
I would say it is, but it isn't. I mean, what ends up happening is that poor parents use the excuse that I don't have any money not to do certain things. And really, children's education has really nothing to do with money. It has to do with a vision that you have for your family and the legacy that you want to leave for your family. And it doesn't matter where your parents are economically. I tell people, both of my parents were high school dropouts. but they made very sure that their four children were going to graduate from high school and that we were going to graduate from college, even though they neither one of them were able to do so.
But that was important to them. That was a priority.
It's a priority, mm-hmm. but it has nothing to do with economics.
Mm-hmm.
It has to do with what's important to you.
Mm-hmm.
And in my family, it was important that we get an education so that we can have a career, we can live a luxury lifestyle, and pretty much get out of our parents' hair.
Well, that's important, too, you know. As you look at some of these trends, have you over the 20 years, what kinds of things have you observed that you think have a direct impact on education?
I would say in those top 10 steps, the first one I'm going to say, withholding love. One of the things that I noticed particularly when a boy gets about 7 or 8,
mm-hmm.
he no longer gets hugs.
Mm-hmm.
And okay. I don't think parents, I mean, I know that they want to make their child macho and all that jazz. But for a kid not to get hugs is just so detrimental because all they're able to express is anger, and that's not good.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't realize how traumatic that was until I was dropping my kids off at school every day, and I noticed every day the number of kids who wanted a hug kept growing to the point it became so disruptive to the school that the principal says, "What are you doing?" I says, "I'm giving a hug." You know, and she was like, "We're going to have to do something different about that." So I ended up going to classrooms every single day to give kids hugs because parents
oh, wow.
are not giving them hugs. Now, we don't think that that's a big thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a big thing, and I'm to just kind of put it in relation, when I became the head of that parent group, that school was doing 28.1 in reading in English. They were doing 39.1 in math on standardized exams
mm-hmm.
here in the state of Michigan. Because of the hugs and my pushing and my expectations of what I wanted from the kids, when we took that test again at the end of the year, we were at 78.1 in reading English. And 69.1 in math. Everybody goes, "Oh, that was such a fluke." No, it's not. Because I hug those kids every single day, when I ask them, "Can you do more homework?" Of course they were going to do more
mm-hmm.
homework for me. Because I'm loving them.
And your expectations.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's a biggie. And it's probably the biggest thing ever. Because too many kids come to school, they don't have love, and they don't have the expectations that something's expected from them.
In looking at children in school, do you see a difference between raising a male versus raising a female?
Oh, most absolutely different. I just tell people, I have a set of twins. I have a boy and a girl.
Oh, okay.
They're born on the same day. So there's no age difference.
Mm-hmm.
They're different. Boys are so different than girls. I mean, they're wired different. I mean, mm-hmm. they're action-oriented type it bodies.
Mm-hmm.
Girls can sit and be still for longer lengths of time. But we make it seem like being a boy is a medical condition. And they're just boys.
Yeah.
They're busy.
Putting on some medication, calm him down so he will not be a problem in that classroom.
Mm-hmm. But my thing is, why calm them down? If they're
right.
excited, use it to your advantage.
Mm-hmm.
Keep them busy. Put them in some hands-on activities so that they can learn, because a lot of them learn with their hands. And they learn very quickly with their hands. But we want them to sit still, be quiet. And I tell people, I don't think that that's effective learning. And it doesn't matter whether it's a black boy. It doesn't matter whether it's a
mm-hmm.
white boy. It's a boy thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But do you think just the system itself influences and contributes to that? I mean, when teachers have 30, 35 in a class, management becomes an issue.
Well,
I mean, I'm just throwing that out there because I know that's what they say. I mean, I got 35 in my class.
Well, if you're good in your craft,
mm-hmm.
35 people is not a lot.
Okay.
When you're good in your craft, when you know how to manage a classroom. Now, I am not an educator by any stretch of imagination.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an economist. But I did have an opportunity to pilot an alternative high school where 70% of our population were boys. And one of the things that I learned in that whole process when you're in charge and everybody knows you're in charge, you manage your classrooms and you have no issues. You could have 50 kids in a classroom and you're going to manage it as just as you would if you had 13, because all the kids know who's in charge.
Mm. Okay.
And they follow and fall in line accordingly. But what I'm finding is a lot of times that people don't have really good classroom management skills. So any number of students will throw them off. Any little disruption. I say that children, they play. That's normal. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm expecting them to play. That's just who they are. So to think that that's a behavior issue is just amazing to me. It's not a behavior issue. Mm-hmm. It's who children are.
Mm-hmm. And it reflects the perspective and how you analyze and label the whole issue. If you label them as a problem, as opposed to a perspective of, well, let's use these behaviors to the advantage. If they're active and involved, then let's turn it around and keep them active and involved.
And I don't think schools look at it that way, but I know when we had our pilot, we did that, and what the kids did not know, because the boys were very active and a lot of them were ADHD, I used it to our advantage. Oh, you want to be in a hurry? Great, because we can move in a hurry. The children were able to cover 2 years of material in 1 year. They didn't realize that they were moving that fast. But if you want to move that fast, we can move with
mm-hmm.
you.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like it was individualized, really. I mean, even though they may not have identified it that way, but it seems like it accommodated the individual needs of each child. If the one was moving fast, we'll move fast. If one is moving slow, then we'll accommodate him too.
And that's the beauty of technology. You can do that. Mm-hmm. You do the individualized learning and things of that sort. But I think that even if you don't have the technology or a one-on-one computer, you can still differentiate in a classroom and cater to those that are moving fast, cater to those who are doing average, and cater to those who are doing slow, and be able to accommodate all of them at the same time.
Ida, you have identified steps to parenting. What does it mean to be a good parent?
Well, we have to talk about what's the job of a parent first.
Okay.
The job of a parent is two things: to protect their children until they become productive adults.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Very basic, very simple.
That's pretty good. I mean, but that's easier said than done.
It is. Mm-hmm. You know, children don't come with a manual, unfortunately, when you're born. Yeah. You know, you're kind of making it up as you go along, or you're using your history with your own parents, and you're trying to figure it out. And that's where the difficulty comes, you know, because unfortunately, in some cases, like some things I followed that my parents did, and there are some things that I absolutely scrapped.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought about it.
Yeah. Can you share the steps, to the seven key steps to parenting with us?
Mm-hmm. I'm going to show you the number. It was actually 10 steps.
Oh, okay.
Number 9 is no regular family time.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Family need traditions. They need to have meal time. They have to have certain dates that things get done, because children look forward to those.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll use an example. In my house, every night was movie night. My children knew that unless it is an earthquake or the world is set on fire, that Friday night we were going to do something related to the movies, which meant you're not scheduling anything to go anyplace else, which means that I'm not having any business events, I'm not having any personal events. That is my date night with my children.
Now, let me ask you, how do parents, because I want to come back to these steps, but I want to get into how do we empower these children to be the best that they can be? And we'll review those steps, each one of them, a little bit more in detail. But is there a recipe that you can provide to help parents empower their children?
I think that the biggest recipe is that because we have so much influence on our children, what we say out of our mouth dictates where our children are going to land. Because we do have such influence.
Mm-hmm.
So, but we don't realize that we do. Like, I use the example, my son, since the time he was born and I saw that he liked cartoons and video games, I declared that he was going into that industry. Mm-hmm. And I talked about it. I had magazines. I showed him what a Bill Gates looked like in Forbes. I showed him all of the software companies as they were coming out and starting up his startups and blooming and et cetera. So that became such a part of his spirit, he couldn't run away from it.
It was all around him.
And today he's finishing up his sophomore year at Rochester Institute of Technology, mm-hmm. and he's in software engineering.
Wow.
Now people go, oh, that's so wonderful. No, I spoke that into his spirit mm-hmm. every single day of his life.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we don't realize that also can work in reverse. If you're always upset with your kid and you're always calling them a son of a bee, mm-hmm. then eventually they're going to be no good because you declared it.
Although I know all children have some real common areas of development, do you find that there are any challenges that vary according to culture and race?
Yes. I would say one of the biggest challenges that I have found in the African American community is just dealing with the community in itself. One of the things that our community continually perpetuates is this concept that I call anti-intellectualism.
Mm-hmm.
We just will tell you in a minute, if you're educated, you speak proper, you like school, you are white, as if that's negative. And you hear it all the time. I mean, it happens to kids. I mean, you're in the hood. If you're going to school and you're carrying books, you're white. Mm-hmm. If you're studying, something's wrong with you, you're white. And it's just a common theme that rolls through our community, whether it's in the hood, whether it's in a fluent community. It's just such a negative perception to get education. And so our children struggle against that whole perception mm-hmm. and just getting something simple as a high school diploma. They're having to fight that every step of the way. Or just speaking proper English, they're having to fight that every step of the way because it's almost as if it's negative mm-hmm. to speak proper dialect.
Let me ask you to hold your thoughts for 60 seconds. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll get right back at you, okay? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. My guest is Ida Bird Hill, author, parent, urban economist, human relations expert, and president of Uplift Incorporated. She shares her insight and expertise on successful parenting and cultivating it in a positive school experience. Ida, we're back. Sorry I had to interrupt you. But are there other challenges that may vary that you wanted to identify according to the culture or one's race?
That's a big one.
Yeah.
The second one is just being an African-American is always seen as being negative. And that's not just perpetuated by the mainstream community. That's even perpetuated by our own community. I chuckle when we piloted the school, and people would walk by the school, and you would watch just about anybody clutch their purse and bring it close to their chest, mm-hmm. as if the kids are going to steal from them. And I just watched that. It didn't matter what color the individual was, they would do that, or they would walk across the street so that they wouldn't have to walk through the children. And it didn't matter whether they were African-American, didn't matter whether they were Caucasian. They all did the exact same thing. And so we had a conversation. What do you think about that? Mm-hmm. And the kids are so, they know that that happens because they've been watching it for decades. But that's so unfair to always label African Americans or Hispanic Americans negatively. Even when we had this recent bombing event.
Oh, yeah.
The first time that they talked about the suspect, he was brown skinned.
He was a dark skinned male.
Right. And I'm thinking, but we had no proof. We had nothing.
Well, we don't need proof.
Nothing.
Hey, they don't need proof.
You know, so that's a biggie. I mean, and it's such a biggie because it does such negative things to young people because it makes them feel like they're so inferior when they haven't even had a chance to even get started. And so we ended up having to combat that. I went, I don't know. When you figure that one out, let me know. Because it goes counter to our history.
Yeah. Let me... Discipline is always difficult. Are there any insights you might share concerning discipline?
Well, I think discipline is tough because we don't really set specific rules.
Mm-hmm.
We don't set specific boundaries. And so consequently, we have to use other methods of discipline. And I'm going to just say it because I don't believe in spanking,
mm-hmm.
which gets me into a whole lot of controversy when I talk about it. And the reason I don't believe in spanking is probably so unusual because when my children were born, I spanked them just like every other family in America who does.
Mm-hmm.
And my great-grandmother said, time out.
Hmm.
And I was like, excuse me? She was like, no, baby. I was like, you spanked yours? She said, because when we grew up in rural Georgia, they could be lynched.
Right.
You are not in rural Georgia in the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
Your babies need to learn how to think. And when you're beating them, you're not teaching them how to think. And that stopped me in my tracks.
Mm-hmm.
And I went, oh, she got a point.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to talk to them, and your job is to teach them how to think. If you set your boundaries and you stick to your boundaries, then they know when they got close to the boundary and they bounce back.
Mm-hmm.
If not, you know what to do with them. So you set specific boundaries, which is what I did, and I didn't have a whole lot of them because I didn't want to remember a lot. And I set those boundaries, and I didn't waver. And it could be something simple as, in our household, bedtime. Up until my kids turned 9, bedtime was at 8 o'clock. We don't have temper tantrums. We don't have whinings. We're not even going to discuss it. Because at 7:30, you're taking a bath, and at 8 o'clock, you will be in your bed in your room. That's it. There is no wavering from the issue. And they will tell you from 0 to 9, that happened every single night, 7 days a week.
But how do we get parents there? How do we get them there?
We have to discuss it because a lot of times we don't discuss it in love. Sometimes we may say it and it comes across in a negative way, but sometimes you have to discuss it in love. I mean, like with the whole bedtime issue,
mm-hmm.
I said to some parents yesterday, your babies need 10 hours of sleep for their bodies to get full rest, but more importantly, for their brains to get rest. So they can function properly. When they don't get that rest, they're not at their top condition. And so they're not going to perform at their best because they're tired.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the parents all looked kind of surprised because no one had ever said it to them in that way. And they went, it even affects their brain? Yes, it does. And so a lot of times kids are not doing well or they're labored hyperactive because they're sleep deprived.
And going hand in hand with that is also diet.
Exactly.
I mean, when little Omar goes to school in the morning and he's had a honey bun and some chocolate milk, what do you expect?
He bouncing off the wall.
Right. Yeah. So how do we combat? Because diet is a major issue.
Well, you know, they don't have home ec classes anymore.
No.
And even when they give food stamps or bridge cards and what have you, I realize they don't even do any menu planning.
Mm-mm.
So you have a whole generation of young people who've never had home ec, who've never had menu planning, and no one really has this conversation with them. Now, I did something that was kind of bizarre because I was in one of the stores, and I noticed I just asked a hypothetical question to one of the young ladies. You guys get your food stamps on a bridge card, which means you don't have to worry about misplacing them. You don't have to worry about someone stealing them. Why do you buy all of your food at once?
Mm.
I just wanted to know.
Mm-hmm.
So then the young lady went on to explain to me because they were going to run out of food, and so they want to make sure they don't run out. So my response was, the reason why you run out, you buy too much processed food.
Right.
And the young lady looks at me like I'm speaking another language. She goes, what do you mean? And so I went on to show her how, you know, you're buying these $5 packs of cookies, whereas if you bought the kind that you make, it's $2 a pack. Mm-hmm. And while, yes, it's going to take you time to make the cookies, but it's a fun activity for your kids, and you're able to buy a lot more. So I was only talking to the one lady. And so, you know, conversation went on for a little bit. I looked up, and all of the lines cleared. And I went, okay, what happened? Everybody got out the line and went and put stuff back.
That's
good. Because no one had ever said that to them.
Yeah, well, we don't have classes teaching parenting, unfortunately, for everyone who becomes a parent.
And that's but we could.
We could. We could.
And let me tell you how we could. One of the reasons why we wrote this book is we teach parent workshops. And what people do not realize that economically disadvantaged schools get some federal dollars called Title I dollars. Part of the legislation says that if you receive those funds, 1% of those funds must go to parent involvement education, namely workshops.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what we discovered is a lot of schools do not use all of the money for workshops. A lot of the schools use a lot of that money for petty cash. So consequently, even though the money is supposed to be set aside for workshops, because the parents never request the usage of it, the schools end up using it for something else.
And the parents probably don't know they have that option.
And they probably don't, because that's been in the legislation for at least 30, 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the reasons why we're going on radio shows is to let people know you have that option. There are monies there that can educate parents. I do workshops in 20 schools right now, and we take the parents on trips, field trips, you know, they go on cultural activities. I mean, to open and expose them to more things, because it improves not only their life, it improves their children's life. And those monies are available.
Yeah. Well, we have to get to a point where there is some mechanism where they are advised and educated about some of these options that they have. And like you said, you know, programs need to inform them. But it may be by design. Maybe they don't want them to know.
And it could be.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would say I would gather probably yes. And my children graduated from Detroit Public Schools during a time when they were quite challenged. And I know that the leadership probably thought that I was a really pesty parent. I probably was. I probably took it overboard because those were my babies.
Mm-hmm.
And I challenged them on every item you could probably challenge a school district, because you have my children in your care. And as long as you have my children in your care, you're going to give my children what they deserve. And saying that you don't have money is not going to be one of the
mm-hmm.
responses, because I know you have the money. It's just, what do you do with
What are you doing with it?
Exactly.
And this,
so parents have to get to that point. So even though they may be poor, they have to get to a point to fight for their kids and to know that your child, even if they're in an urban setting, they're getting, when you add all the federal dollars and all of the extras that they receive, they're getting monies that are equivalent to a suburban school district.
They have to recognize that they have a voice, and a voice that needs to be reckoned with. Basically, You know, and I don't think they have an appreciation for that because they've been overlooked. They've been disenfranchised. They are insignificant. They've been told that they were insignificant. The behaviors that indicate that they're insignificant. So those parents feel like they don't have any other avenue.
And they do, but they have to also look at some of the examples before them. I look at Ben Carson, and I use his story a lot, because his mother did not have more than a third grade education, but she was determined that her son was going to college, if that was the last thing that she was going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And almost it was. She made him come home and read and do his homework every day. She made sure that she popped in on the school to make sure he wasn't having issues with teachers. She made sure that he was getting the necessary ideas of how to get to college. And although she couldn't read herself, she made sure that he sat and he read regularly. So it doesn't really matter what economic bracket a parent is. It doesn't matter what education level they're in. There are some things that they have to do as a parent to set their children on the next level, on the next path. And part of it comes back to having routine meals, routine homework, mm-hmm. routine bedtime, routine discipline, because that stability is what gets kids to the next level.
In this technologically advanced world, do you feel that kids are growing up too fast? I mean, they're overexposed to sex. There's growing disrespect for life. And that's a question I always like to ask those who are interested in the education of children. This world is moving very fast, but do you think it's too fast? And is there a way that we as parents, educators, can address this?
I don't think that the world is moving too fast because the technology and all of that is moving quite fast and it's going to just speed up.
Mm-hmm.
But what I have the issue with is that parents don't do the protection they need for their children. And it doesn't matter what the world is doing, is what do you do in your household? And I'll use a good example. When my kids were younger, the Simpsons cartoon came out. And I remember having this argument with my son. He must have been about 11. And we had one TV in the living room because I like to sit and watch what they're watching. And he had turned it to The Simpsons. And I was like, hand me the remote control, please. And he gives it to me. And I turn it. He goes, but Mom, everybody else is looking at The Simpsons. Am I everybody else's mother? He went, no. So do you think I really care that everybody else is looking at The Simpsons? The Simpsons is an adult cartoon. You are not an adult. So you will not be watching Simpsons until you almost become an adult. Mm-hmm. So you have 7 more years to get there. Now, he was upset. Yes, all of the other kids in school were talking about The Simpsons. He had no clue.
He didn't know what was happening.
But this is my house.
Right.
I run my house. And there are some things and images that I don't want you to see, and you're not going to see them. And I don't really care what other people do.
But that leads to the role of television playing parent or babysitter. And we see that television and computer now serving that role.
But that's because parents choose that, because mm-hmm. the television and the computer are very powerful educational tools
mm-hmm.
if used appropriately. Now, I say we looked at a lot of the Travel Channel, a lot of the National Geographic. My kids went all over the world through television and the computer. They learn all types of scientific things through the television and computer, thanks to Discovery and a whole host of other channels. But what happens is that we don't utilize those. Children do not naturally gravitate to those shows. Parents have to expose them to those shows, which is why I advocate that while you have a TV and you have computers, you really should be watching those TVs and those instruments with your children so you can have discussions with them about what they're seeing. Because children don't really know the difference between fact and fiction, and parents really have to explain that to them because they just have a hard time deciphering. So I don't think that, TV in itself is wrong. I don't think that the computer in itself is wrong.
It's a lack of supervision, huh?
There you go.
Mm-hmm. That's what I hear you saying. As we look at what kids study, what about the arts? And, you know, the arts are always the first thing that is cut when we look at education and money is tight. But how significant do you feel the study of the arts is?
Well, I believe that the arts is probably one of the most significant subjects in school, and it pains me to see it wiped out of budgets. I have lots of education friends, and I always say that if you don't have a dedicated art teacher, they can blend it into every subject. The reason why arts today in the 21st century has probably taken on a greater role is that America, actually the whole world, is living in what we call a creative economy. For 100 years or so, we were in the Industrial Revolution. You know, everything was really manufacturing-based, and people put in labor, they made with raw materials and made things. We're not in that world pretty much anymore. People are taking ideas straight out of their head and with technology are creating new products. So it requires that kids have to have some creativity. And the only place that you really learn to hone those creative skills is in the arts. And one of the reasons why you see that children are not critical thinkers is because we have wiped out the arts where you learn how to free think, how you learn how to utilize and your imagination and take it to the nth degree. And when you don't have arts, whether it's visual arts, whether it's performing arts or musical arts, children don't learn those skills.
Mm-hmm. Hold your thoughts for one moment. You're tuned in to 411 Teen. We're going to take a break, and we'll see you in 60 seconds. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield, and joining me from Detroit, Michigan, is Ida Bird Hill. She works as a change agent for Uplift Incorporated, where she has personally led the transformation of four public schools. Ida, I had to interrupt you when you were talking about arts. Were there any closing thoughts you wanted to make on the importance and significance of arts in education?
Even if schools don't have money for arts, parents really should be demanding that they blend the arts into their other four core subjects. You can put art in mathematics because geometry is nothing but art. You could put art in English. That's where drama comes from.
Mm-hmm.
It's literature in action. You can put the arts in social studies. You could put the arts in science. So even though schools may not necessarily have a dedicated art teacher, they can blend arts in every core subject there is.
Mm-hmm.
And that now makes that core subject a little bit more exciting to the student. It's a different conversation in physics to talk about the theories of physics, but it's a whole different conversation to talk about the theory of sound and relate it to music.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what music is. It's sound. It's physics in action.
Exactly. Now, I know we have skirted around, and what I really wanted to talk to you about, because you identified 10 steps to guarantee a teenager drops out of high school. And I think we addressed one of them, and that was withholding love.
No, and then number nine. No regular family time.
Uh-huh.
You don't have any regular family time. Your teenager is probably going to drop out because you don't know what they're doing.
Okay.
Living a life outside of your teenager.
What does that mean?
Oftentimes when kids get about 12, they're built like a grown-up.
Mm-hmm.
And so we think that they don't really need our guidance. We can let them go do their own thing. Wrong. Because there's so much for them to get in trouble, and that's when you need to probably monitor them most. But you don't have to be where you lock them down. Sometimes you have to have the environment open where they can bring their friends to the house and enjoy themselves so you can see what they're doing and what their friends are doing.
Mm-hmm.
That prevents drugs. It prevents, you know, sexual issues. It prevents a whole lot of things because you are now living your life with your teenager. Number seven is embracing anti-intellectualism. I am amazed at how many parents, even though they said they want their kids to graduate from high school, a lot of the things that they say says otherwise. When the kid wants to study, why are you reading? Why are you on the computer? You know, like, mm-hmm. why are you learning? And they're not realizing that that's contradictory. That's anti-intellectualism.
Ida, what do you think is the role of the parent as far as some parents say, I want to be a friend of my child. I want to be my child's friend. Or I don't really want to be seen as that authority figure. Would you talk about that just briefly?
When I hear that, it makes me cringe because you are not your child's friend.
Mm-hmm.
And you're never really going to be your child's friend because you're their parent. Now, with that being said, I do believe that if with good communication skills, you can have a very good relationship with your children for their entire existence. I have such a relationship. My kids have always talked to me about everything, even stuff I don't really want to hear. You know, but I listen. Their friends come and talk to me about stuff I really don't want to hear, but I listen because I keep the lines of communication open without being judging. But at the end of the day, I'm the parent.
Mm-hmm.
I'll let you voice your opinion. I'll let you tell me whatever you want to. But when I say we're at the end, I've heard enough, here's my ruling. That's how it goes because I'm not their friend. I am their parent. And my job, again, is to protect them until they become productive adults. And part of being a parent is protecting them. And you can't do that when you're their friend.
Indeed. Communication, though, is something we always hear that parents struggle with. Do you have any hints, suggestions on how they may enhance communication?
I would say the first thing is you have a structured time when your children spend time with you. One of the reasons why I preach family meals, because that's an opportunity over food, when kids are least suspecting it, that you can talk about the day's activities and share your activities, they share their activities, and you get to know your kids. But what happens, I'm noticing, in a lot of families, family mealtime now sits in front of the TV.
Yeah.
So they're having correspondence with the television.
That's true.
And you really can't do that. The second thing is that I always had dedicated time that I'm spending with my kids because I'm an entrepreneur and I could work 24/7, but I had to say to myself that I can't do this. I have kids. So Friday nights were, and my household was movie night. Saturday night was board game night. And then on Thursday nights, we would go to some arcade. So my kids know Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, that is our date weekend with my mom. And nothing moves that. I mean, it could be a multiple million-dollar deal. It can wait
until
Sunday.
That's a priority.
Because they are a priority for
mm-hmm.
me.
Mm-hmm.
And that has been that way from the time they were born. And I chuckle because they're in class. They're in college now. They're 19 years and they're finishing their sophomore year. And even still, when they come home, the first thing they do, hey, Mom, let's go to the movies. So I go to the movies. They cart their 5 or 6 other friends that come with us
mm-hmm.
because they've gotten accustomed to that being a date night with their mom. And it does. And if you can't afford it, because sometimes I couldn't afford the movies, so sometimes we did first-run movies, sometimes we did the dollar movies, and then there are sometimes we couldn't even afford the dollar movies, we did the video at the house.
But there's a way that it can be done, and that's the point.
Exactly. Uh-huh. And we always dressed it up. So even when we did it at the house, because there was a time that we were really struggling financially, I called it we would call it movie night at the Hills. Give them a little invitation and pass out to their little friends in the neighborhood. And I would have all these little kids sitting in front of my TV, passing along our microwave popcorn and our drink.
But it was effective, and it's very important, and that's what they need.
And it was fun because you had a party-like atmosphere, and it was simplicity at its best. But it was our date night with each other.
And parents need to understand that they don't have to have a lot of money to do these activities, to foster this communication.
Exactly. Or even something simple as, my kids didn't know this, they know it now, but when they were growing up, on Saturday nights we did board games. Mm-hmm. Now, to them it was just fun. But for me, it's educational, because Scrabble was always part of the thing, Trivial Pursuit, mm-hmm. you know, just a lot of different games, but they were able to learn strategy, they were able to learn vocabulary, they were able to learn a lot of different things that was reinforced by board games. Now, when they got about to the 10th grade, they decided, we're too old for that.
Yeah.
And I just chuckled because I was like, okay, well, I guess they are old. They're pretty sick of that. But then one of their friends came maybe like 6-7 months later and said, Mrs. Hill, what happened to board game night? And he came with his board game.
Mm-hmm.
And my kids said, you know, we're a little old for that. He was, oh, please, get over it. And so they went back to board games.
That's great.
Because their friends remembered board game night.
Mm-hmm. That's great. That shows you the impact that it had. Six, I think you were on six, refused to oversee student homework. Was that
classwork? That's a biggie for me.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you really want children to understand that education is important, homework is part of education. Homework and studying, because homework is what the teacher gives you. Studying is what you're weak on, and both should occur in the household.
Mm-hmm.
And I personally believe, and I know my kids hated it, I oversaw homework every day until they graduated from high school.
Well, that's what's needed. Pardon me. That's what's definitely needed. Of course, some parents say they can't oversee homework because they can't do it. They don't know.
Well, but my thing is, you may not know the answers to what's right and wrong, but the reason why you oversee the homework is it forces your children every day to have a routine that you are going to do homework.
Mm-hmm.
So don't come in my house and tell me the teacher didn't give you any, because if she didn't or he did not give you homework, then mommy has homework for you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, parents go, when they get older, that's too much. No, it's not. My daughter had a geometry teacher who called me one day and said, you know, Karen is not doing homework. I went, really? Because every day I've been asking her about homework, and she says you're not giving her any. And it was early in the year. I said, don't worry about it. I will fix that. I gave my child 5 hours of geometry homework. She was so tired because she was so accustomed to going to bed at 9 o'clock
mm-hmm.
that she was up till midnight doing homework. She was so tired. To watch her crawl up the stairs, to get to her bed was hilarious to me. So when she got to her room, I said, here's the deal. Either you're going to do Mrs. Tolliver's homework, which I'm sure is probably only about an hour, or you're going to do my homework, which is 5 hours. She looked me squarely in the eye and says, I think I'll take Mrs. Tolliver.
Well, she had good judgment there, didn't she?
Absolutely. Well, the next day she goes into class and she takes a little quiz, because Mrs. Tolliver was giving quizzes every Friday, and she gets an A. So Mrs. Tolliver says, what did you do? I said, baby, I gave that girl so much homework. She will never, ever miss your homework ever, ever again.
That worked. It was very effective. What's the next step to guarantee?
Number five is no career in education goals for teens. Teens need to have some place of where they're going to land. Where are they going? Mm-hmm. Are they going to college? Are they going to skilled trades?
Mm-hmm.
Or are they going to the military?
But they need some place.
They have to have some place.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I say this because parenting is about pushing your kid out of the nest. In order for them to be in a productive adult, like every other animal in the animal kingdom. Your job is to raise them and then push them out of the nest. We're not pushing our children out of the nest because we know they're not ready to leave.
Mm-hmm.
Because we didn't prepare them to leave. And we have to do that. We have to. They have to have career goals of where they're going. Or I used to joke around with my kids. You have three choices: shelter, college, military.
Okay.
I really don't care which one of them you choose. But at 18, you are leaving my house.
Oh, this is great. We are running out of time. We need to run through the other, I think, what is
Number four? No,
yeah.
Family goals.
Mm-hmm.
Number three, set no boundaries or discipline. Number two, speak ill to or about your teen. And number one, pretending like everything is okay, even when it is not.
Elaborate on that, because I think that that's very important. I think all of them are very significant, but I think that we see folks pretending like everything is fine and there's no problem and all is well.
If you're poor, admit it.
Mm-hmm.
There used to be honor in being poor, because the honor was is that we're poor today, but baby, when you come out rocking, you're not going to be poor anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But we have no honor in being poor any longer. We try to buy Cartier glasses like we're rich. We're buying Louis Vuitton purses even though we can't eat.
Right.
And there's no, and we're just acting like everything is okay. Whereas when you assess your situation and say we're poor, and you tell your kids we're poor today, but this is how you're going to get out of poverty. You're going to get this education. You're going to get a high school diploma. You're going to get post-secondary training, and you're going to leave my house. And if you say that every single day, eventually your children will do that.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're pretending like everything is okay, they never get to that point. They never have goals. They never understand I have to do something to get out of this poverty or out of this situation that I'm in.
Well,
and
Ida,
that is detrimental.
Thank you. It has been real, and I think you've shared some invaluable information. To my listening audience, tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Teen. This edition of 411 Teen was produced by Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Technical engineer, Evan Rossi. Audio copies are available, and if you would like to participate in 411 Teen or have topic suggestions, call 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. That's 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. If you would like to subscribe to 411 Teen podcast, log in wfsu.org.